There's something ponderously pachydermic about that music, which is not entirely inappropriate. Not entirely inappropriate to our next story. There are some mothers, I guess, who dream that their baby girl should marry a prince, live happily ever after. Well, be careful for what you wish. Beatrice Faulkner was a respectable Melbourne matron in the 30s. Now, little girl Joan did marry a prince and did live happily ever after, but what a prince. He was as old as Joan's father. He was Indian, he was a Muslim, and he was already married. Tali Muhammad Khan ruled over a small and dusty principality in the northwest of India, a long way from Bombay or Delhi. He brought Joan to live there. She converted to Islam, took to wearing saris, but remained in many ways a Melbourne girl of her time. Now, Joan's story has been told by her cousin once removed, Suzanne Faulkner, and the book, as I've said, is called Joan in India. The connection, Suzanne, is that your mother was a cousin of Joan's.
My father. My grandfather's youngest brother's daughter was Joan. So I'm not quite sure what that makes me.
Well, it's close enough, for heaven's sake. Now, how did Joan and her new hub meet?
Well, Joan was travelling around Europe with her mother, Beatrice, and they attended a spa in the Black Forest. Tali was there because he'd fallen off a polo pony in his youth. And he spotted Joan across the dining room, I'm led to believe, and fell in love with her.
Enchanted evening.
Exactly.
One of those.
Started pursuing them around Europe. Beatrice was most offended when she found out because she'd actually thought the prince was pursuing their little party because of her.
Dear, oh dear, nothing like that to divide mother and daughter. But Mum didn't quite understand the secret courtship, did she? Because you talk about gifts and letters arriving, but Beatrice had no idea that Joan was planning to scarper to India to marry.
Apparently not. Or not till the last moment. Then there were some discussions, and I think Beatrice and Lee probably thought that she'd given up the idea until one day they discovered she'd gone.
Tell us about the British Principality of Pelhanpur.
Well, it was part of independent India. As you know, in those days, India was divided into British territory and the princely states. And Tali's little kingdom was a long way, as you said, from the rest of civilization. It was said that Joan felt quite at home there because it most resembled the Riverina in a drought.
What an interesting observation, really.
Well, she'd grown up on a sheep station.
But a sheep station wouldn't have 125 servants.
No, or a private army or several palaces and a hunting lodge.
What was the population of his principality? Was it
a couple of hundred thousand.
So not to be sneezed at. And he had a few bob.
He had a few bob, nothing compared to, say, Jaipur or Hyderabad or some of those much larger principalities.
But, of course, Joan came from a quite wealthy background herself, didn't she?
Well, I think this was one of the reasons that the Nawab was attracted to her, because he knew that she wouldn't be marrying him just for his money. And a lot of the European women that did consort with the princes were basically after what they could get.
What were his relations with the Brits like?
He liked the British, but he was a very shrewd man. He knew he had to deal with them diplomatically. He wanted not to have his affairs run by them. I think another reason was that he thought Joan would be a diplomatic asset.
Well, she's a very beautiful woman, as I can see from the shot on the cover.
Yes, and she was also well-trained.
She has a hauteur there, which...
She does, and she was only 22 or so when that photo was taken.
You know what it reminds me of? A couple of the portraits of powerful women by Norman Lindsay. There's a very Norman Lindsay quality.
There is, rather, isn't there?
To that face. Yes. Now, this bloke's no fool. He's intelligent, he's well-educated, so he could defend his autonomy with the Brits.
Yes, but I think he also thought that with Joan to brief him on manners and mores, she would be quite useful to him, and she could be a hostess, and she could chat charmingly and charm their wives and so on.
Talking about wives, plural, let's deal with the fact that he had one already.
He did have one. He'd been married through an arrangement when they were both 15 or 16. She was said to be an invalid. She would have been in her 50s too. She'd produced the son and heir, who was roughly the same age as Joan, and she'd more or less retired into purdah and a religious life. And Tarly wanted a companion.
But you make an interesting point. The wife is allegedly an invalid, but as a Muslim in a Hindu country, it might have given him great difficulties if his second wife was Indian.
I think he'd decided that he wouldn't marry another Indian woman. He wanted an educated woman who could travel in Europe with him and be at home in Europe. I don't think he... It's hard to tell. He never made any effort to find a second Indian wife.
Now, Suzanne, I understand this is not the first time a major figure in India had married a Melbourne girl. There was a Raja who married a Miss Molly Fink.
Yes, the Raja of Pudukkottai. And that caused a precedent that caused a lot of trouble for Joan and Tarly, because that had really turned into a mess.
This is because the Brits, I understand, frowned on mixed race marriages.
Well, they believed that such marriages would be unacceptable to the subjects of the prince if he presented an offspring of the marriage as the next in line to the throne. You'd have someone who wasn't of the right race, wasn't of the right religion, perhaps, and that this would cause instability. And the British very much wanted to keep the princely kingdoms in a stable state.
Well, if we go back to the Raja who married Miss Molly Fink, that was in 1910, I understand that they would not formally recognise that marriage.
He ended up giving up his kingdom and going to live in Europe. So
heavens above, like the Duke and Duchess of Windsor.
Exactly. So the precedent was not good.
Yeah. Did Tarly want Joan to be called Her Highness?
He wanted her to be recognised as his wife, as his legal wife, and to be treated with respect. And if the Raj and the English court refused to recognise her, she would be treated as a concubine, never invited anywhere, and would not be able to be received by any English official.
Isn't that outrageous? Now, how high up the British hierarchy did this request have to go?
Well, the Viceroy refused, and Tarly kept making diplomatic forays, chatting up various officials, getting them on side, working the people he came in contact with. Finally, Mountbatten intervened and took it to the king. And just before independence, the king gave his permission. Mountbatten...
Initially, I understand, HM had knocked it back.
Yes.
He had to be worked over.
Yes.
Right.
It took Tarly, from 1939 to 1947 to achieve his end.
A lot of paperwork went into this?
A lot of paperwork.
You found the paperwork?
I found the paperwork in the India Office Library, and it's a masterpiece of bureaucraties. There's a file roughly 4 or 5 inches thick of correspondence on this precise matter of whether she should be called Her Highness or not.
I'm talking to Suzanne Faulkner about Joan in India. Meanwhile, back in Melbourne, back in Toorak, I guess. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. What was happening there? Lots of scuttlebutt?
Well, there'd been gossipy stories in the newspapers when she left. Her father, Lee, had been so shocked and horrified that he'd disinherited her. Later, when he met Tarly, he thought he was a wonderful person.
Oh, he re-inherited her, did he?
And he re-inherited her, yes.
How about that?
He was frightened that she'd be forced into purdah, that she'd be mistreated, that Tarly would tire of her and discard her, and then she'd be ruined socially and psychologically.
How did Mum feel about it, given that you at one point thought that she was the target of his ardour?
She took a lot longer to forgive Joan, but eventually, I mean, time went by. After Tali died, he died in the mid-50s of cancer. Joan was devastated. She left India eventually and went to live in the Switzerland and then the south of France. And the family, I think, was entirely reconciled by then, but it took a long time.
Suzanne, when you were researching the story of this commendable young woman, did you find much written about her in the Melbourne press?
Not a huge amount. The family was very private and they wouldn't have given much information away. So the gossip columnists more or less had to write about what they could find, and then the story more or less dried up. And Joan never brought Tali back to Australia.
I understand that at least one gossip columnist described him as her dusky and elderly affianced.
Yes, yes.
So he never got to Australia.
He never got to Australia.
Right. So, but you insist that it was, as far as it can be assessed, a happy marriage.
I think it was. I think Tali was someone that you couldn't help but like. I mean, I knew nothing about him when I started the research, and I was more or less in love with him myself by the end of it.
Yeah. Okay. She was beautiful. We've established that. I think very beautiful. He loved showing her off, didn't he?
He did, yes. Yes.
So he'd parade her around and everyone would go, ooh, ah.
Not so much through the streets of Palanpur, but if he had a banquet or he was entertaining the British, she would put on some beautiful jewels, she'd put on a beautiful sari and be a gracious hostess, and I think that pleased him.
One of the things I always observed and enjoyed about Indian culture was that people are very good at relaxing. It's a great country for lounging around. And she was, by all accounts, a pretty good lounger.
Well,
I mean, she was lazy.
One relative said that, but I think in a palace with 100 and however many servants, it would be very easy to be lazy. She was described by others as undertaking work with the hospitals and orphanages of the town.
Ah, she did good works.
So I don't know how much weight to give to the lazy comment and how much weight to give to the Angel of Mercy comment. I mean, either could be propaganda.
How did the struggle for independence play out in Palanpur?
Well, Tali, of course, lost his kingdom, as did all the princes in the end. They were gradually manoeuvred into giving up more and more rights. Initially, they were invited only to give up foreign affairs, defence, and a couple of the sort of the more major external powers. Then gradually, their palaces, everything was whittled away by degrees.
Yes, that's perfectly true. And yet, even today, there's still this shadow of imperial grandeur in India. There's still quite a lot of pre-Raj respect for the aristocracy.
For the princes, yes. Yeah. Most of them aren't rich anymore. I mean, some of them are. I travelled round in a jeep with the Maharana of Danta, overlooking his little farm where he bred horses and was trying to improve dairy herds and things. And it was interesting. I mean, all those years later, everyone we passed would make a respectful namaste and just smile. I mean, they were obviously very glad he was still living within their little community. But I think now the proponents of princely splendour are the great industrialists who have these weddings for their daughters that cost millions of dollars and
yes, well, that's a cheap one costing mere millions. Now, of course, Tali's family had been ruling the place for, 600 years?
Something like that, yes. They were the longest ruling Muslim dynasty at the time of independence.
His family was?
His family, yes. They're continuously ruling. Of course, they'd come down from Afghanistan as sort of, you know, warrior bandits stealing cattle and women and gradually penetrating into the Hindu the kingdoms and setting up their own little enclaves.
He knew Gandhi.
He knew Gandhi.
What did he think of him?
I think he admired him because... And Gandhi, I think, liked him because whenever he travelled through Palanpur and the railway from Ahmedabad to Delhi went through Palanpur, he would arrange for the train to be stopped and he would climb on board. And as the train progressed slowly through the dusty plains of Palanpur, they would sit and chat about the future of India, and Tali would supply him with some vegetarian food and
so he wasn't hostile to the emerging India. He had some sympathy for democratic ideals.
He was trying to turn his own administration into a more democratic one by having elected councils and elected officials rather more quickly than the principality could actually cope with. He was sort of pushing because he thought that things were going to change, and if his kingdom was going to survive, it would have to survive in a democratic form.
That now it sounds like Lampedusa's the leopard. The only way things stay the same is if they keep changing. Yeah.
Yes. He was very astute, and he was a realist.
And he got on quite well with Mountbatten. Clearly, if Mountbatten was an advocate for his marital status with his relatives in Buck Palace.
Well, I wondered for quite a while if Mountbatten had only helped him because he was to keep him on side in persuading the other princes to follow the same path towards modernising their states, towards independence. But Tali had actually signed the accession agreement and persuaded his neighbours to do the same before Mountbatten intervened.
It's one of the great sort of puzzles of history, or not a puzzle, it's a simple fact, that the British found it so advantageous to have these Muslim princes helping them govern a Hindu country.
Well, Tali was very much an anomaly. I think he was the only Muslim ruler of a majority Hindu state, just as Kashmir was the only Hindu ruler of a Muslim state. And of course, we all know what happened to Kashmir when partition occurred.
Now, as the princely states were handed over to the Indian central government, I understand the princes were put on a pension.
Yes.
Well, a stipend.
The princes voluntarily relinquished their powers. They were given a guarantee by the government that they would be able to keep their palaces and certain privileges. Gradually, all those privileges were whittled away.
Did Tali go back to Palanpur?
Sorry?
Did he go back to Palanpur and see what had become of his little country?
He felt he couldn't because he was disappointed with the way things turned out. He was disappointed with the turmoil. And in fact, somebody once said to him, he was seen at a party once drinking wine, and somebody jovially said to him, "You're a good Muslim, why are you drinking wine?" And he said, "I'm drinking wine because I don't want to go to heaven. If I go to heaven, I'll meet my father, and he'll ask me how I lost my kingdom."
Oh, dear. So after Tali dies, Joan doesn't stay in India, but as you point out in the book, he knew that she couldn't handle money, so he left whatever dosh there was, in charge of his son.
Yes, and I think Joan was not best pleased with this arrangement.
And Beatrice's mum then comes back into Joan's life.
Well, Joan couldn't take money out of India, and she chose to go back and live in Europe, so she more or less left with nothing except her personal possessions and a few jewels, which were not the state jewels, but personal presence to her from Tali. So at that stage, Beatrice came back on the scene, organised for Shamim, her daughter, to go to an English boarding school and organised Joan's finances so that she'd have something to live on.
You actually met Joan. You knew her a little.
I met her in the south of France, yes.
And by then she was getting on a bit and was losing her marbles.
She was. Mm. And she drank me under the table.
Dear, oh dear. Did she keep a diary, a journal, anything to help a young writer like you put the book together?
Not really, no. No, she was very elusive. She was very reclusive. It took me a long time to track her down and quite a lot of effort to persuade her to meet me.
Is that right?
When
and
I
of course,
did...
by then she's pretty well broke, isn't she?
No, well, she still had an income to live on, but like a lot of older people, she was convinced she didn't have enough money, so she lived in this sort of strange mixture of miserliness and extravagance.
Joan of India by Suzanne Faulkner. You'll sell the movie rights any moment now. There's a story for made for the big screen. On an oh, I should point out that it's published by
Australian Scholarly Publishing.
It's a fine-sounding publishing house. And thank you very much for your time, Suzanne. On our next, we'll be catching up for the very last time this year with Bea Campbell. And we'll talk about how the atomic bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki were a consequence of the erosion of moral inhibitions on bombing civilians and resulted in the nuclear arms race that we're still witnessing 60 years later. That's a wrap from Late Night Live. Let's listen to Elena Katz-Chernin. And stick around, please, for the news on Radio National.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.